I will not touch the microphone. It's in my way, but I'm not going to touch it. One of our favorite topics of conversation in the church is, where are you going for the Feast of Tabernacles? We talk about it pretty much all year long, but interest always picks up this time of year because with the coming of the Spring Holy Days, we know that the registration for the feast will also begin soon, and we'll start to make our formal plans. So where will you be going? The Rural Meals have been buzzing all winter long. By now, the church has selected this year's sites, and we know that they'll be announced officially really soon. I'm not certain where the site will be in our region. I've heard some things, but don't know for sure since it hasn't been actually announced. Pretty sure it will not be at the Catskills or Lake Harmony. Of course, the local or assigned feast site is only a technicality, unless you're me. There's rarely a restricted site. Well, Italy was one this year. They had a limited number of sites, a special registration for that. But members are free to transfer to any open site that has not reached capacity. So that gives you the opportunity to travel, to see different parts of the country, or even to go internationally if you'd like. Of course, for the ministry, the opportunity to travel and to attend the feast is a little bit different. The pastors generally attend the regional site that's assigned to the church areas so that the number of pastors and elders is balanced out so that all of the different sites have an adequate number of elders and pastors to serve. We go to the assigned local site unless we're asked to serve elsewhere. A couple of years ago, my wife and I were asked to go to South Africa. And that was a very special and interesting, exciting trip for us. In addition, every third year, the pastors have an opportunity for a personal transfer. So last year, we requested and were able to attend in Jamaica. So, since we've been elsewhere for the last couple of years, we're looking forward to attending the local site this year. And that really is fine with us. Regardless of where we observe the feast, it certainly is a highlight of the year. So as we begin to think about the Feast of Tabernacles, this seems to be like, it seemed like it would be a good time to talk about one aspect of our preparation for the feast. I'm sure you've been asked in the past, maybe by family members or friends, co-workers, your boss, or maybe even neighbors, they ask you, how can you afford to make that trip every year? Who can afford an 8 to 10 day trip to some resort every fall? I wonder how that happens. As we know, of course, God has a savings plan that assures us the resources that we would need to travel to and to observe the feast. And not only that, but also to provide assistance for those who would not be able to attend the feast on their own. And of course, in spite of what your co-workers and neighbors and friends may think, this is not a vacation. We know that this is something that God commands His people to observe, and along with the other annual Sabbaths, the Feast of Tabernacles is a highlight. So it's only reasonable, and I guess even fair, of God, since He requires us to do so, to make a way possible for us to be financially prepared. Last sermon, we talked about what we call the first tithe. The tithe of our increase that we send to the church, which is used to fulfill the commission Jesus Christ gave to the church, to preach the gospel of the kingdom to the world, and to care for those members that God draws into the church. But there's another application of the tithing law that provides us with that financial means to observe the annual Sabbaths. God providing both the Sabbaths and the means to afford them helps to illustrate how important those days are to God and His intent that we observe them and that we enjoy them. We commonly refer to this as second tithe because it's in addition to what we called first tithe. But of course, another perhaps more descriptive name would be the festival tithe, because that's the purpose of that money that is set aside. So we have that first tithe that goes to the church. We have the festival tithe. And of course, many, when they come into the church, are kind of set back and maybe shocked a bit to learn that there's even a third tithe. And they start wondering, what about the fourth and fifth? But when they find out there's yet another tithe, that presents even more of a challenge for some as they begin to come into the church. Again, we call it third tithe, but when we look at the purpose that it is for, it might be more descriptively called the assistance tithe. As I pointed out last sermon, the Bible does not label these as first, second, and third. That's kind of church speak. That's how we refer to them. However, Scripture does reveal three distinct tithes, each with its own specific purpose. So the title of the sermon, to follow up on the last one, is, the sermon today is, The Festival and Assistance Tithes. The Festival and Assistance Tithes. So we want to pick up from where we left off. We were talking about the tithe last time, but let's do a quick review by going back to Numbers chapter 18. Numbers chapter 18, just to kind of set things in context and see these tithes as each one is mentioned. Numbers 18, verse 21 says, "Behold, I have given the children of Levi all the tithes in Israel as an inheritance in return for the work they will perform, the work of the tabernacle of meeting." Drop down to verse 23. "The Levites shall perform the work of the tabernacle of meeting, and they shall bear their iniquity." Now, that's an odd phrase, but what it means is that the Levites would have responsibility for what happens at the tabernacle. And if things go well, that's to their that speaks of them, but if there's any problem, they bear the responsibility. At any rate, they have that serious responsibility to God, and it's a statute forever throughout your generations. Verse 24, "For the tithes of the children of Israel, which they offer up as a heave offering to the Lord, I have given to the Levites as an inheritance." I skipped over verse 23, where it says that Levi would not receive an inheritance in the land of Israel. Instead, they were to receive as their inheritance the tithe of the rest of the nation, which would support them as they devote themselves to work at the tabernacle. Some asked as well about this phrase, the heave offering. It's a little bit odd. The word heave in the Hebrew just simply means to present or to lift up. So it's talking about just lifting up or presenting an offering to God is the meaning of that Hebrew, or that phrase, in the Hebrew that's translated, of course, into English, the heave offering. So it's just simply about offering or lifting up to God a sacrifice. So the Levites were to receive this as their source of their income, since they would not have any other inheritance in the land. They would be supported by the tithes of the rest of the nation. We saw in Leviticus chapter 27, verse 30, that this is a holy tithe. Leviticus 27, verse 30 says, "All the tithe of the land, whether of the land, of the seed of the land, or the fruit of, or the tree, is the Lord's. It is holy to the Lord." So it's important to recognize that when we receive our pay for the work that we do, that God has given us the opportunity to earn that and to have that source of income, but we're told that part of it is still His. Part of it belongs to God. It is holy. It is not for our personal use. Some have been confused as well by verse 31 in this chapter. It says, "If a man wants at all to redeem any of his tithes, he shall add one-fifth to it." Now, that's, we need to consider the chapter in its context here. The chapter 27, throughout this chapter, the primary theme or the subject is determining the monetary value of things that are dedicated to God to redeem those for ourselves. In other words, we, in effect, replace what is God's with we exchange it for money in order to redeem it for our own use. So that's the theme that goes through the chapter, a number of different items and things that are redeemed. The high priest establishes a monetary value. The person can then present that monetary value to the priest in lieu of or to redeem what is God's. So the point here about tithing is not that you can withhold tithe and not pay it for a while and then repay it later at a 20% interest. That's not what this is about. This is about an exchange that takes place at the time the tithe is paid. And if a person who is presenting that tithe would rather keep the commodity, then he pays the value of that commodity plus 20% for the tithe instead. That commodity might be his corn crop or his apple orchard crop or whatever it was in their time. So, God is not doesn't work with you like your credit card does. Okay, where you have to you borrow something on your credit card and then you spend years and years paying it back at some exorbitant interest. That's not what this is about. This is about an exchange of your commodity with God and providing the cash payment instead, and is done again at the time the tithe is paid, not something that's delayed. So if you go back and read the chapter, you'll see this is one of a series of examples about what can be redeemed and how it is done. Now, for us, our tithe is based on financial income, monetary income, for almost all of us. And so this kind of redemption is really not relevant to the way that we pay our tithe. Anyway, that's kind of an aside. We also, in the previous sermon, read in the book of Hebrews how the authority for receiving the tithe was transferred from the Levites to Melchizedek. That was a significant change, part of what changed when the new covenant was established. Instead of having a physical human priesthood, we now have Jesus Christ who serves as our high priest. He replaced the Levitical priesthood. And the authority to receive tithes, which we saw in Numbers 18, was given to the Levites, was then transferred to the order of Melchizedek. He had the authority then to receive the tithes of the people. But that, as we saw in Hebrews, required a change in the law. Not in the law of tithing, but in the law of who can be high priest. The Levites, and specifically the family of Aaron, provided the high priests. In order for Jesus Christ to become the high priest, a law had to be changed because Jesus Christ was from the tribe of Judah. And so that law was changed that would allow him then to be the high priest. But the law of tithing continued. Since Jesus is the head of the church as well as the high priest, then, and he has given the church the commission to do his work, then the tithe that we pay goes to him by going to the church. And we discussed that in the previous sermon. So now let's consider the festival and the assistance tithes. The festival tithe is mentioned in Deuteronomy 14, verse 22. Deuteronomy chapter 14, verse 22. It says, "You shall truly tithe all the increase of your grain in the field, or that the field produces every year." Sounds like tithing. Whatever you harvest, whatever your increase is, you tithe on it. But notice in verse 23, this does not the same tithe as that which was given to the Levites. It says, "And you shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain and your wine, your oil, the firstborn of your herds, your flocks, in other words, all of your income. You are to eat of it yourself, so that you may learn to fear the Lord your God always. And so this tithe is to be consumed by the one who saves it. It is to be done at the time and the place that God instructs. If the journey is too far, then you can exchange the commodities or the tithe for money, and then use that for your travels. It goes on to explain in the next couple of verses. Notice in verse 26, one of our very favorite verses as we keep the Feast of Tabernacles, that you shall spend that money for whatever your heart desires, for food and wine, whatever you would like to enjoy before the Lord. So with this tithe, we travel somewhere, we feast, we enjoy whatever we would like to, we relax, we spend this time with God, learning to fear Him, and we rejoice before God, you and your household. So this is a very different tithe than the one we talked about before. This is one that we consume. However, we consume it at the time and at the place that God specifies. So to make it possible for us to make this journey and to have this celebration, God tells us to set that tithe aside so that we have the resources we need. Deuteronomy 16 also speaks of this tithe and this celebration. Verse 13, speaking about the Feast of Tabernacles, says, "You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles for 7 days when you have gathered from your threshing floor and from your wine press." The Feast of Tabernacles, of course, is in the seventh month in the early, late summer of the year. And in the way that God established the agricultural cycle for Israel, it was after they brought in their final harvest of the year. And so it says, "You shall rejoice in your feast. You and your son, your male servant, your female servant, the Levite, the stranger and fatherless, and the widow, all who are within your gates. 7 days you shall keep a sacred feast to the Lord your God in the place which the Lord chooses. Because the Lord your God will bless you in all your produce and in all the work of your hands, so that you may surely rejoice." It's interesting that God tells us to set aside that 10% of what we have earned, the increase we have had during the course of the year, and to spend it on ourselves for an enjoyable time, because He will bless you in the upcoming year. He will bless you in your hands, in your produce that is to come. So that we have the assurance that as we celebrate, we look forward to God's continued blessing. So these two verses tell us a bit about how this tithe is to be used, what it is for. Of course, as we move into the New Covenant, there is no evidence that any of God's feasts were changed or rescinded. People like to assume these were Jewish days and that they're no longer required or necessary. But that is never the way that they're presented. They're presented to all of Israel to obey and to observe, not just to one small tribe of Israel. So the feasts were not changed. They were not rescinded. They didn't go away. Jesus Christ specifically stated that He did not come to destroy the law, and that nothing of the law would pass away until all was fulfilled. Again, another interesting point to us, the holy days tell us how things will be fulfilled. And they show us the progression of how that plan will eventually be accomplished. And so the holy days, as part of that law, will continue until all of that is accomplished. We know that these holy days are commanded assemblies still, as they were even in the time when they were first given to Israel. We find a little bit of evidence in the New Testament of the observance of the holy days. It's not emphasized a great deal, but we don't, again, find anything that says they weren't observed or that they were changed to any other celebration. And we see a couple of examples of those days being observed. John 2, verse 23. John chapter 2, verse 23. The point is going to be that since the days are still to be observed, then the tithe to prepare for those observances is also still part of God's law. John 2, verse 23. Now, the Passover of the Jews was at hand. Now, John uses that phrase, of the Jews. It was the Jewish people. This was in Jerusalem. It was the Jewish people in Jerusalem who were observing these days. But it does not mean that it's only a Passover or a day for Jews to observe. So it was at hand, and Jesus went to Jerusalem. And this is an occasion where he was offended by what was happening at the temple, and he cleaned it out. Drop down to verse 23. When he was in Jerusalem at the Passover during the feast, many believed in his name. So we see here that Jesus Christ was in Jerusalem on the Passover, and it says, and he observed the feast. Well, what feast would that be? Unleavened bread. He was there and he observed both the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. We see that as an example of what Jesus practiced. By the way, there's also mentioned in Luke 2, verse 41, of Jesus' family observing the Passover. This is the time when he was 12 years old. And his parents went to Jerusalem, and he kind of wandered off into the temple and was discussing things with the rabbis. They were observing it. That was when he was a child. This, of course, is an example of him observing it as an adult. We also know he observed the Feast of Tabernacles, John chapter 7, verse 2. John chapter 7, verse 2. Again, the same kind of a phrase is used here. The Jews' Feast of Tabernacles was at hand. And his brothers said to Jesus, well, why don't you come with us to the feast? Jesus was reluctant to travel with them because of the timing and the situation. Verse 10, when his brothers had gone up, then he also went up to the feast. Not openly, but as it were, in secret. So he didn't make a big show of going to the Feast of Tabernacles, but he did attend. He traveled to Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. So we see Jesus' example, at least in two cases here, that he continued to do this. We find also that the disciples and the church continued to observe the annual festivals as well. Of course, after Jesus' death, they observed these feasts years after he had already died and been resurrected. Acts chapter 20, verse 6. Acts chapter 20, verse 6. Luke is writing here of some of the travels of Paul and his those who were with him. It says, but we sailed away from Philippi after the days of unleavened bread. And then later joined others. So the observance of the Feast of Unleavened Bread is used as a benchmark. It would only be used in this way if it had some relevance or meaning to the people who were reading of it. It gives evidence that, again, they were observing those days together. Later in the chapter here, verse 16, Paul decided to sail past Ephesus so that he would not have to spend time in Asia, for he was hurrying to be at Jerusalem, if possible, on the day of Pentecost. He was wanting to be there, again, a special time for the church, and he was hurrying to be at the feast of Pentecost in Jerusalem. One thing to note here, however, the Israelites were to travel where God placed his name for them was at Jerusalem. That's where they would go to observe the holy days, the feasts. But notice, as we saw in verse 6, that Paul observed the days of unleavened bread at Philippi. It was no longer necessary in the time of the new covenant to travel to Jerusalem to observe the holy days. Just as an aside, you could also come to the same conclusion as you look at 1 Corinthians chapter 5. 1 Corinthians chapter 5, where Paul, writing to the Corinthians, urges them to observe the Passover and the days of unleavened bread at Corinth. verse 7 relates the symbolism of the days of unleavened bread. The physical symbolism was still practiced as a sign of the spiritual meaning. Purge out the old leaven that you may be a new lump, since you are unleavened. For Christ our Passover was sacrificed for us, so therefore let us keep the feast. So we find again, and of course 1 Corinthians 11 is a detailed explanation of how to observe. Or is it 10? 1 Corinthians 10 is detailed, you're right, it's 11, is a detailed explanation of how to observe the Passover. So the holy days are definitely observed in the New Testament. And of course, the means for observing them is also still practiced as well. Now, since we do observe all the holy days, but since the Feast of Tabernacles and Last Great Day are the festivals now that we travel to observe at regional locations, most of the festival tithe that we set aside is used for that observance. It's not inappropriate to use a portion of our festival tithe for the other holy days as well, but we need to be sure that we have the what is necessary to travel to observe the Feast of Tabernacles. So, as the Scripture shows us, this tithe is to be saved for and spent during the festivals. It is not to be used at other times of the year or for other purposes. So it's money that we set aside for those observances. One other important point about festival tithe, let's go back to Deuteronomy 16 again. Deuteronomy 16. We've already read this, but I want to emphasize a couple of thoughts here in verse 14. It's talking about observing the feast for 7 days. Rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter and your male servant and your female servant and the Levite, the stranger and the fatherless and the widow, all who are within your gates. This shows us an important principle regarding the use of festival tithe and our responsibility to one another. All of Israel, and therefore all of the church, is to be a part of the observance, including those who may not have enough festival tithe of their own. People who were servants or fatherless or widows were included among those who should be cared for and provided for so that they can observe the Feast of Tabernacles along with all the rest of us. Now this we can consider in light of the fact that there are those who don't have enough, and there also are those who have more than they need for themselves to just observe the feast. Several times over the years, people have come to me and said, well, why should I save a whole tithe of my income when I only need maybe a third or a half of that to go to keep the feast? Why do I need to save all that additional tithe? Well, this gives us an idea of what the responsibility is, that we should be sure that all who are part of God's church, all who are part of this church family, are able to observe the feast together. So the instruction regarding this tithe is not just to save what you need for yourself, but to save a full tithe, and if you have excess of that, then it can be used to help others so that they can also enjoy the feast. We can help people directly, and often people do that. They know of a need, and they provide for someone directly if they have opportunity. Or you can also send excess or festival tithe that you don't need for yourself can be sent as a donation to the church. The church has a festival assistance program which will help those who do not have sufficient tithe on their own. Again, this will typically include members who are elderly, people on a fixed income, those with chronic health problems, those with a spouse who does not support them in observing the feast, a number of different circumstances where an individual might need some assistance to be able to attend the feast. This assistance fund is limited, but the church is willing to actually go beyond what the actual second tithe assistance fund or festival assistance fund includes, and they will draw money from the primary church account, that is what we call first tithe, in order to be able to help those who would request to go to the Feast of Tabernacles. They've determined that's a legitimate use of that money as well. However, they certainly best not to have to do that a great deal. So members are encouraged to be thoughtful and helpful to others during the feast, to provide for them in whatever way they can. The church, as far as I know, certainly locally, and I've read, I believe, a report fairly recently that the church has never turned away anyone who needed festival assistance. As long as they were good, solid, faithful members of the church. So the church emphasizes the importance of and provides us the best it can to provide a means for people to be able to attend. Now, the assistance that is provided is modest. It's not going to provide an elaborate Feast of Tabernacles, but should be enough to enable people to attend who otherwise would not be able to. So, those of us in a position where we have more than we need have that opportunity to serve others so that we can all observe the feast together. Certainly the church does expect those, each person, to do the best they can to provide from their income at least what they can toward the observance of the feast. There's a personal responsibility as well. But this is a kind of a quick overview of the festival tithe, how we use it, how we save it, and how we share so that others can observe and enjoy these festivals as well. So let's consider then the assistance tithe. We find that introduced in Deuteronomy 14, verse 28. We've just read of the tithe that we use to observe the festival. Verse 28 says, "At the end of every third year, you shall bring out the tithe of your produce of that year and store it up within your gates. And the Levite, because he has no portion or inheritance with you, and the stranger and the fatherless and the widow who are within your gates may come and eat and be satisfied, that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hand, which you do." Deuteronomy 14, verse 28, introduces another tithe. This is a tithe that is to be brought forward every third year. And it's to be used to provide assistance for those who are in need. The list here is similar to what we saw regarding the Feast of Tabernacles. It includes those who are in the category that would likely be less able to earn a great deal of money, the fatherless and the widow, and others who are in need. The strangers are referred to a couple of times here. It would include those who have begun to attend the church but have not yet fully members of the church, but who are part of us. And specifically in Israel's time, it would refer to those who are from other nations who were living within Israel. But these were the individuals for whom this tithe was to be collected was to benefit them. And notice that by being generous and setting this aside, it says at the end of verse 28 that God will bless you in all the work of your hands when you provide for others in this way. Also note chapter 26, verse 12. says, when you have finished laying aside all the tithe of your increase in the third year, the year of tithing, and have given it to the Levite, the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, so that they may eat within your gates and be filled, then you shall say to the Lord, that continues with the thought. But the point is, again, it makes mention of the providing of this tithe every third year for those who are in need of financial assistance. So this kind of introduces a bit of an arithmetic problem. If this tithe is to be saved every third year, how do we know when every third year is? Well, we find a principle in Leviticus 25 that helps us to see how this was determined. What was the third, every third year when they would save this additional tithe? It was not a tithe that was required, every year, but every third year. Leviticus 25, verse 1, says, the Lord spoke to Moses on Mount Sinai, saying, speak to the children of Israel. When you come into the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune the vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year there is a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land, a Sabbath to the Lord. Interesting. We are to rest every seventh day in the week, but God provided a way for the land to be replenished and to maintain its health as well by not being farmed every seventh year. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard. What grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not eat, you shall not reap, but gather the grapes of your untended vine, for it is a year of rest for the land. This is a agricultural law that has been consistently overlooked. And farming does not function on this in this way. The farmers, of course, would scoff at this and think it to be impossible. That every seventh year they just don't plant a crop. And then how would they survive? Well, if you drop down to verse 18, God explains that if you observe my statutes and my judgments, perform then, and you'll dwell in the land safely, the land will yield its fruit, and you'll eat your fill and dwell there safely. And they say, well, what do we do in the seventh year, since we will not be sowing or gathering? Then I will command my blessing on you in the sixth year. It will bring forth produce enough for 3 years. The sixth year would have a crop so abundant, it would carry them through the land Sabbath year, the seventh year, and through the first year of the next cycle, because they wouldn't have a crop yet till the end of that harvest season. And it would be enough to carry them through for that entire period of time, if they would obey God's rule, or God's law here of the land Sabbath. So we find here a seven-year cycle. In this seven-year cycle, the seventh year was a year of rest, and then a new cycle would begin. So the third tithe was saved within this seven-year cycle, in the third and the sixth years of that seven-year cycle. And remember that the sixth year, that year before the land Sabbath, would have a huge crop, so that it would be enough to provide for not only the needs of the people in general, but also provide for those who are in need, as it carry them through until the next third tithe year, which would be the third year of the next cycle. God thought this through, don't you think? And he provided a means for caring for those who need help, and he promised to provide for those who are giving the help. One of the realities of life, and Jesus pointed it out in John 12, verse 8, he said that the poor you will always have with you. There will always be situations or circumstances, mostly or most often beyond the people's control, where they turn out to be in need of financial help. Nobody plans to be a widow or to be fatherless. Nobody plans to have the serious financial issues that are to be dealt with through this system. This is a tithe. This part of the tithe system is what God established so that we can fulfill our responsibility to one another, to show our care and concern for one another, and to be sure that those who are in need are provided for. However, the system of government and taxation today is far different than it was for Israel. Today, most Western-style governments, democratic-style governments, the United States, Britain, Canada, Australia, Scandinavia, Europe, these governments provide welfare for their people. They withhold taxes, and in some cases, exorbitant taxes, from wage earners for the purpose of providing welfare to the needy. This subsidy or these monies can provide food, medical benefits, rental subsidies. The governments spend money in all those areas to provide for their citizens, and especially those who are in need. So the governments then have, in effect, taken responsibility for providing for the needy. They use our tax money to fulfill the purpose of third tithe. The church recognizes that through this taxation system, members in effect are already paying an amount that exceeds third tithe. So the church has determined that it is not necessary for members to pay an additional third tithe to the church. Now, to be clear, the church still believes in paying third tithe. If this governmental system were suddenly not there, then it would be our responsibility to provide for those needs for one another. Some take a look at this policy and they say, well, they conclude, no, the church doesn't believe in third tithe. Not true. We see in Scripture that third tithe is to be provided for those in the church who are in need. But the point is that our government, again, has taken the equivalent of a third tithe and more and uses it for the same purposes as third tithe is intended. So we believe in paying third tithe, but it is in our situation administered differently. The church encourages members who have financial need to seek government assistance, to go to the government for the programs that they offer. That's why they are there. That's what those programs are for. But we all know that the government programs are sometimes poorly administered and do not always distribute assistance in a way that is fair and adequate for those who are in need. So for this reason, the church also maintains a member assistance program, which is used to fill the gap where government programs fall short. So if government assistance is not adequate, the church will do its best to help meet the need. Depends on what the situation is, but the church will provide assistance to members where the government fails or falls short of fulfilling that commitment that they make through taking the taxes and putting into that welfare type of a system. The church assistance program is funded by members' contributions. Again, we recognize that the equivalent or more of third tithes are to being paid, but an assistance program is still necessary, and its source of income is contributions from the membership. We don't turn everything over to the government and tell them that they can just, and then turn around and leave it at that. We have a responsibility to one another. We have a responsibility to care for and to reach out to help others when we have when we're in that position. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 16. You know, just a principle just to look at and to consider that God expects, we are expected to contribute and to share with one another beyond just what this taxation system provides. Hebrews 13, verse 16 says, "Do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices God is well pleased." God is pleased when we see a need and we're willing to share in out from our resources to provide help for one another. Remember that in James, this is not really an example. Well, the point of what is written in James has to do with faith. But he says, you know, would you look at your brother who's hungry and destitute and say, well, be warm and well fed, and then turn around and walk away? Now, the government will take care of it and turn around and walk away. That would not be something that we would do. God expects us to be responsible to one another and to share from our resources with one another. So this third tithe thing doesn't take away from our opportunity or responsibility to be generous with one another. Proverbs 28, verse 27. Proverbs 28, verse 7. Says, "He who gives to the poor will not lack, but he who hides his eyes will have many curses." It's easy for us to look at something, at a situation, to be aware of it. We don't want to just turn away. If we help others, we will not lack. There's a real blessing in being able to help others. And, you know, honestly, you find that sometimes the most generous people are the ones who really don't have as much, because they know what it's like to be in need, and they're more willing to reach out to and to help others. So those who are in a position to do so certainly are encouraged to help as we see the need, and directly and specifically, but also to donate to the Church Assistance Fund, to provide the money that the church can use to help those who are in need. If you choose to do that, you can simply include a note on the memo line of your personal check how much you wish to send or to be allocated to the assistance fund, or you can do so if you donate electronically online. There's at the church's donation site, there's a little drop-down menu where you can specify how you want your donation to be applied. So there's a simple way of doing so. The idea or the need for assisting others certainly puts a burden of responsibility and care, and it shows how we do provide for and take care of one another as a church family. Now, some of you were in the church years ago before this administration of the third tithe was changed, and you actually paid a full third tithe to the church the third and sixth years. That was a challenge for you. Those were lean years. Those were challenging times. Those were times when you sacrificed a great deal. But most members who went through that had that experience will tell you of special, even miraculous blessings that they received during that year. And just as God, as we saw in Deuteronomy, when we reach out to and provide and take care of others, God takes care of us. Those who give to the poor will not lack. And so those were some of the best memories you'll find if you ask other members of years in the church, those special blessings that came during that time of the third tithe year. With that in mind, there are those in the church who, even though they understand this policy that they're not required to pay an additional third tithe, still choose to do so. They're in a position financially where they feel like it's not enough that they let the government do this job. They want to be doing so themselves. So they desire still to pay a third tithe, as is laid out here in Leviticus. The church certainly doesn't, there's nothing against that, nothing wrong with that, so long as it doesn't put you in a place where you need a third tithe to get by. If you can, if people who can afford to do so find that they just want to share in that way, and that's perfectly, it's a fine attitude to have. But again, the church does not see that as a requirement. Just to fill in a little bit of information, if you were to choose to do that, how would you know when the third and sixth years are? Well, the church has determined that the best way to do that would be that the first year of your seven-year cycle would be counted from the Feast of Tabernacles closest to your baptism date. So, for example, if you were baptized in November, you would back up and start your third tithe year beginning at the Feast of Tabernacles you had just observed. If you're baptized in August, you would look ahead to the Feast of Tabernacles coming up, and you would begin your third, that would be the first year that you would count of a seven-year cycle. This way, frankly, in the church, it's kind of staggered. Not everyone is paying, would be paying third tithe at the same time, and it provides more of a flow of money into a third or an assistance account if people choose to do it in that way. Another way that some have chosen is that if you average it out, if you take, what would be, how much would you pay if you paid 10% 2 years out of seven, it averages out to about 3% per year. So some people have just decided, well, we'll just send an additional 3%, you know, constantly in as an offering for third tithe, and then that over a seven-year period, it averages out to be the same, pretty much the same as it would be if you paid 10% 2 years out of seven. Those are options. Those are things that some have chosen to do. Just wanted to explain the church's administration of third tithe, that primarily we see the government doing that, and then we supplement that with donations to the assistance program. Now, there are those who teach that really there's only one tithe, but it's used in three different ways. That's what many believe to be the truth, or what they believe about tithing. But we see, as we look at these scriptures carefully, that the Bible indicates three distinct tithes. Our first, second, and third. The tithe that goes to the work, the festival tithe, and the assistance tithe. There's a footnote in the New International Version Study Bible, the Zondervan edition, that I find interesting. The NIV is a translation that we don't really fully trust, because they often will incorporate some of the Protestant ideas into their translation. But they offer an interesting footnote in their study Bible on Leviticus 27, verse 30. Here's what it says. It says, from these passages, it appears that Israel actually had three tithes. One, the general tithe paid to the Levites. First tithe paid to the church. Two, the tithe associated with the sacred meal involving the offerer and the Levite. Now, that's kind of a strange thing, but they use that phrase, but then in parentheses, they show a verse that refers to the Feast of Tabernacles. So this tithe is associated with, as NIV understands it, with the observance of the Feast of Tabernacles. We call it second tithe. And they say the third is the tithe paid every 3 years for the poor. So even the New International Version recognizes, the scholars who did it recognize in this footnote the three distinct tithes, and describes them much like we would. So again, I'll just say that if you have any questions about the subject of tithing, and by the way, I want to mention that I'm covering this not because I'm correcting any problem or even challenging any current false teaching, but just to provide, I think, a good review of the understanding we have about this particular doctrine. And we'll be reviewing other doctrines, of course, as well. But if you have any questions, read the study paper. If you still have any questions, then you can ask, and if I don't know the answer, we'll find someone who does. We'll find out what the proper way would, because sometimes there are some very specific questions or technical questions regarding tithing in a proper way. But we know that in general, this is a way for us to learn to be generous. We're very protective of our money, of our resources. It's natural for us to be, but one of the challenges we have as Christians is to fight our nature, isn't it? Remember what Jesus said in Luke 6, verse 38. Luke 6, verse 38. Jesus said, "Give, and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over, will be put into your bosom. For with the same measure that you use, it will be measured back to you." Whatever size vessel we use that would represent the amount that we give, Jesus Christ promises that it will come back to us in this way. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, and running over the top. God is incredibly generous with us, with not only just the physical resources we have, but we just stop and think about what it is He's promised us, why He created us, what He's giving to us, and we deserve literally nothing of that. So we are to learn to be generous as God is generous, and tithing is just one way that helps us to learn that lesson. Tithing is a very important part of our life as a Christian. It's a way of obeying God, worshiping God, and honoring God. It's a way to be part of the work that God is doing through His church. And it's a way for us to learn to show our respect, our concern, and our love to one another.